with Dr. Y.T. Chen, and he's been working on glycogen storage diseases and Pompe disease for a long time. What I'd like to do first is summarize a little bit about what Pompe disease is as far as the way I see it, and then that'll sort of lead into the progress we've made. So as I see Pompe disease, it's obviously a genetic disorder. It's a recessive disorder. That means everybody has two copies of every gene in their body. They inherit them from their parents. One copy they get from their mother, the other copy they get from their father. So we have sort of backup plans, if you will, for every gene in our body, of which there's estimated to be 40 or 50,000 genes that make us human. So if you have a problem in one of those genes, you can end up with a genetic disorder. And so it turns out that in Pompe disease, you inherit a genetic defect, if you will, or a problem in a gene called acid alpha glucosidase. It's a big name, and what I'd like to call it now is GAA for short. Now, if you inherit a mutation in GAA on both of your genes, you will end up with a form of Pompe disease, and it all depends on what type of mutation you inherit will determine what type of problems you will have. So classically, it's broken down into three groups of patients, although it's really a spectrum. You usually hear people talk about the infantile form, the juvenile form, or the adult onset form, which is basically broken down by age of when your first symptoms become noticeable to either your relatives, most likely, or your physician. The infantile form is what most doctors know about because that's what they learn in medical school. The infantile form is usually presents within the first few weeks of life with failure to thrive, poor weight gain, respiratory difficulties, cardiomyopathy, which is just a disease of the heart, and lack of the heart ability to pump. And typically, and unfortunately, children that have infantile Pompe disease die by the time they're a year or two old from the massive cardiac problems and or the complications of not having a good respiratory function from the muscle weakness in the diaphragm and the lung muscles. Now, there's juvenile and adult onset forms, and these are typically just, I don't want to say minor, but they are relative to the infantile form. The features are not as dramatic. Your symptoms come on later in age, and depending on what age it is when you're diagnosed, typically people may classify you as juvenile or adult onset. And typically, all this has to do with is the type of genetic mutation that you have inherited that determines what type of onset you will have. And so obviously, the more severe genetic mutation you have, the more likely you'll show up as a younger patient. So obviously, the infantile patients have mutations that totally knock out the GAA gene in one form or another, whereas a juvenile or adult onset form may not have a complete knockout of the gene, but a partial knockout, and thus they have enough residual activity to sort of get them through the first few years of life, but eventually it kind of catches up with you. Now, the thing with Pompe disease is that this GAA enzyme sort of acts like a vacuum cleaner, if you will, in your muscle cells. And what it does is clean up glycogen that is accumulating in muscle cells. Glycogen is an energy source for muscle, and typically your body stores it and then gets rid of it. And that's what this enzyme's job is to do. And so obviously if you're missing that enzyme, you won't be sweeping up that glycogen, and it'll accumulate in abnormal amounts in your muscles. And so depending on how much accumulation you get and how rapid it is will determine whether you're going to be an infantile patient or a juvenile or adult onset. This enzyme is unique, and it's unique because, in fact, if you present this enzyme, which is a protein, you can actually give it to a muscle cell, and a muscle cell has little receptors on it that will grab hold of the protein and drag it inside the muscle cell where it can work to break down glycogen. And that's a unique feature of lysosomal storage diseases in general, and Pompe disease is fairly unique in that it's muscle, the target tissue we're talking about. And so early work by a couple groups, Dr. Chen's group here at Duke and Dr. Royce's group in the Netherlands, obviously, focused on trying to genetically engineer the GAA enzyme in a form that they could just deliver it to patients. So there's several ways you can do this. Obviously, you need technology, you need advanced technology in order to produce a genetically engineered protein and farm it up in a laboratory and produce enough to give it to patients. Both groups achieve that through different mechanisms that I don't want to go into. And both groups have shown that if you give babies this recombinant enzyme, as well adult patients, although less of them have been treated than the babies, in a fair number of cases you can see pretty good improvement in muscle function, which suggests that the enzyme, if you deliver it into the vein as an infusion, that it can go out, be distributed by the bloodstream to all the muscle cells in the body and be taken up and able to start clearing that glycogen out. There's several problems with that approach, although it's relatively speaking, it's right now it's showing great promise in many of the clinical trials, and I've been involved in some of the first ones and seen it for myself. Some of the problems, though, are that the enzyme, in order to get the enzyme to all the muscles of your body, is quite a task. It's a task because 40% of your body mass is muscle. And so you're trying to correct every cell in your body, and this requires a large amount of this enzyme, because in reality it's not effectively taken up by muscle cells. It's not an efficient process. And so it's nothing like what most people are used to when it comes to taking a medication where small amounts can cause big dramatic effects. For this enzyme, you need a lot. Mm. And that turns into production issues, I think, and that's why the trials have been slow to advance, because it is a difficult thing to try and set out to do, first of all, to make a recombinant enzyme, and secondly, to produce the mass amounts you'd need for an adult patient or several infant patients. So that's one problem with the enzyme. The other thing is you have to repeatedly infuse it. Now, personally, I don't think that's a big deal versus no treatment at all, but it might be nice to decrease the frequency of how often you might have to get an infusion, and those are things we're investigating in our trials right now and making progress. And so those are some of the issues, and so another way to go about doing this is understanding that this is a genetic disease, is to try and correct the underlying genetic problem in an individual. And this becomes difficult because how are you going to correct every cell in your body that has the genetic mutation causing Pompe disease? And so there's several groups working on this. My group is working on this. There's actually several groups at Duke. Dr. Coberl is another investigator. Barry Byrne at Florida has been working on this. There's several groups in Europe working on this. Are we there? Now the way to do this is to deliver the genetic information that encodes the GAA enzyme, if you will, the blueprint, and try and deliver it into a human patient in a manner that allows that information to go into a cell and start producing the enzyme for the body to have access to. And there's several ways to do that. Unfortunately, they're all very inefficient right now. Remember, I told you that it's difficult enough to make enough enzyme to deliver it to a patient. When you start talking about delivering a gene that then will have to get into enough cells to produce enough enzyme for a patient is sort of another order of magnitude difficulty. But we have been able to make some dramatic results in several animal models out of my lab. And what we've done is basically the following. We've taken a cold virus that normally would give you a cold, and we've taken the genetic information out of that virus and modified it. So now it looks just like a cold virus on the outside, but on the inside it contains the genetic information that's missing in Pompe disease patients. And we're able to make this virus, this vector, if you will, that I'll call it now, we can make this in large quantities. In fact, in some ways, it's easier to make this virus than the enzyme, personally, from my point of view. Now, what you can do in animals, and we've done this and published this, is that, and there's several animal models of Pompe disease that we use. There's mice that have Pompe disease that we have, and these were created by several groups. Again, Dr. Reusser's group, as well as Nina Rabin's group, and Dr. Rabin supplied those mice to us. And we've been able to inject this virus intravenously into these mice. And the virus, just from anatomy, homes in on liver tissues.
Mm-hmm.
And when it goes into the liver, it's able to start, it delivers the genetic information to make the GAA enzyme at such a high level that the liver actually secretes the enzyme to the rest of the body. And in so doing, the body gets enzyme and all the muscle cells get enzyme. And we've been able to show in mice that a single injection of that vector can last for 6 months at least. So whereas right now we're injecting enzyme once a week, maybe once every other week, this vector is able to deliver a lot more enzyme over a greater period of time after a single injection. And we've also repeated that in another animal model of Pompe disease. These are quails that we have at Duke that also have Pompe disease. And these were actually the animals that we first tested the Duke form of the enzyme in and showed that it showed some effects. And so we were pleased to see that the gene transfer approach works in that animal model as well. And so we've shown this repeatedly now for several years, and we've tried to figure out some of the problems, which there are several. One major problem that's holding us back from moving into the clinic more rapidly to try and attempt this in Pompe patients is that the dose of virus we have to give in order to get the liver to produce enough enzyme for an entire body, you know, muscles, is such that if you estimate out and extrapolate from the weight of a mouse to a weight of a human, the dose becomes such that we know that at those doses we would very quickly run into toxicity problems. It would basically be like getting a massive flu-like response. And so what I'm worried about personally is that I don't want to treat patients, I mean, that I know that we have a very limited potential for success because we have a very sort of narrow window in which we would be able to do a dose escalation. For example, we likely the authorities would make us start out at a very low dose in patients, and you only can get one injection. That's the other problem with this. It's not like the enzyme where you repeatedly can get infused. Your body will remember you got infected with this virus and will not allow it to come back in again. So you only get one shot per patient. And so what you would do is slowly increase the dose in subsequent patients. And what I worry about is that we might hit a point where we can't go higher on the dose at too early a stage where we haven't seen a good response in the patients, and that would stop the trial prematurely. And so what we're working on in my lab is trying to figure out how to decrease the dose or decrease the toxicity of a given dose in order to get a good response. And that's what I'm working on right now. And so what I would envision, I think, and what will likely happen is that we continue to see really dramatic results with the gene transfer approach for this disease, and I do not think that it's just a pie-in-the-sky sort of maneuver that we're just doing in mice and quails. I think it's real. It's one of the more dramatic, as far as in scientific circles, when I present the data, most scientists are pretty impressed with what we're able to do and are hopeful for Pompe patients based on that. I see probably an evolution such that we might combine the two therapies, So, for example, I'll give you a little vignette of what I envision will eventually evolve. It'll probably come to the point where enzyme will be approved for human use, and the question will become about having enough for all the patients and what the doses will actually be. And I think there is a serious question about production capability and how much can be made and how much is the appropriate dose for a given person of a given weight, for example. And what we may be able to do is, in fact, come up with a sort of a dual-pronged approach where we might have a patient come in and initially get treated with the gene transfer vector to initially sort of clean their body out of glycogen, if you will, sort of come in for a clean up. And then once your body is pretty much cleared up of glycogen, then we would start you out on enzyme replacement, which can be delivered, you know, once a week or once or twice a week, and maybe at a lower dose than you would normally have to give if you were just giving enzyme by itself. And the combination of the two, I think, might afford a more rapid response as well as a longer response, as well as an ability to maybe broaden the scope of therapy overall to all the patients that are affected. So that's what I think may happen. That's my kind of view of where I see things going. And so if I were a Pompe patient, I would be thinking to myself that, wow, here's several avenues or opportunities that could potentially treat this disorder. And I can tell you, of the thousands of genetic diseases that I encounter in my clinical practice, I'm still convinced that Pompe disease has one of the highest hopes that one or both of these lines of therapy will eventually overtake it. So that's where I'm at right now. And I'll gladly take any questions or comments, if that's an appropriate summary for you.
I have a question. How is the second injection tolerated? Is it cleared more rapidly on the second infusion?
Oh, of the virus?
Virus, right.
Yeah. So what basically happens, it's called an amnestic response. And so it's sort of like getting vaccinated. You know, when your children get vaccinated, it's so that your body makes an immune response to the virus because it doesn't want to get infected with it again. It thinks it's another cold.
Mm-hmm.
And so what your body does is sets up antibodies to block the virus from coming in again. And so that prevents it, the virus, from going to the cells we want, which in many cases is the liver. And so that's the reason why we only really have one chance. Now, it's not an absolute blockade. In fact, there are maneuvers that you can do in humans that you can actually transiently deplete someone of antibodies. So what we do in the clinic right now is, in fact, we can bring patients in and sort of hook them up to a machine where you run their blood through a filter that filters out all the antibodies that are floating around. And it'll last for about 24 hours. And usually when we infuse the virus, it only takes a half an hour for it to get into the liver and start working.
Wow.
So we can transiently deplete them of antibodies and hopefully allow that second injection to work. Now, the other possibility is, and these are things that are already proven, is that there's actually 41 to 50 different types of cold virus out there. That's why you repeatedly get colds. You see, you catch a cold, and then you make an immune response to that type of cold. Let's say cold number 31. But then your son or daughter comes home and sneezes cold number 21 on you. Well, your body's never seen that before, and you got to go through the same infection. And now you're resistant to 31 and 21. But you see, there's 40 of them out there. So we can do the same thing. We can actually make gene transfer vectors out of each of these 41 different vectors, and hopefully come up with maybe a catalog. Whereas, let's say you'd come in and you received at your first try vector number 21, and then maybe, again, this is my vision, maybe 5 years down the road where you need another clean out, you come in and we'll give you vector number 31. So that kind
of... You could, yeah, that makes sense. Do you mm-hmm. think you can clear the glycogen in a single dose? Or?
I do.
Okay.
If we can give enough of the virus. So we've shown that in animals, in mice and in quails, that within 17 days, actually, we can clean out the glycogen in all the muscles of the animal. And it's pretty dramatic. And the heart muscle is always the first to respond the best, then followed by the diaphragm, then followed by the skeletal muscles. It seems like the skeletal muscles are the toughest nut to crack.
Would have some effect on the hip flexors.
I'm sorry?
It would have effect on the hip flexors then?
Yes. I mean, we've shown this in the mice already. So, now the question is, and here's one thing to keep in mind, is what damage is already in the muscles? And even if you clear out all the glycogen, one thing I can't tell you, and this is a big question, is how reversible is muscle damage? Okay, so let's say you've had 10 years of Pompe disease where your muscles are very weak, and now we go in and clean out the glycogen. Will the muscles now magically gain their strength back, or will it take a while for them to rejuvenate? I don't know that, although I do know in the mice that when we clear out their glycogen when they're young, they seem to get stronger rapidly. If we do the same thing when they're old, they don't respond as well. And that's because their underlying muscle disease has been there so long that they've developed contractures and underlying changes like that that you would not expect to correct, you know, overnight.
Is the remodeling of the muscle cells themselves, or is it just the loss of muscle cells over time?
I think it's both. I think it's both. So it all depends. And then different muscle groups may respond in different ways. Some groups may respond quicker than others.
And does in youth, doesn't muscle tend to regenerate better than as you age?
I think so. I mean,
divide as well.
I mean, I know I'm feeling it as I get older that I'm not quite moving as gingerly as I used to.
Right.
The thing about muscle, though, it is a regenerative organ, and so that's a plus. That if you take away the insult, which is glycogen accumulation, you may in fact I'm certain it would improve it at some level. The question is how much, and I just don't have a gauge for that in someone with advanced long-standing muscle disease. I think the odds are much higher, and this is just, you know, it's logical, that someone that had less involvement when they first got treated would be more likely to respond because they have less underlying damage to sort of overcome.
Well, here's a kind of curiosity question.
Yes?
If you were to combine it with some sort of a cell, like a stem cell.
Mm-hmm.
Would that also help out in regenerating the muscle and improving the disease itself?
It could. Now, remember, the underlying problem with all these things is you got to get every muscle cell in your body corrected, or a sizable fraction. And so we're not just talking about 10 or 100 or 1,000 cells. We're talking about tens of hundreds of thousands of muscle cells being corrected simultaneously in your body. Stem cell technology is another avenue that people are investigating. And, you know, the hope is that you can take a cell, let's say, out of your bone marrow and put it into your, and take it out of the bone marrow and inject it into your muscles, and now those stem cells become new muscle cells. So the hope would be if you could take stem cells from a normal person and put it into your muscle, let's say if you had Pompe disease, that those donor cells would now become new muscle cells.
Wow.
Now, yeah, that is a big wow. The question is, how efficient is that process?
Mm-hmm.
And now, again, I'll give you my opinion. And my opinion is biased, and it's biased because I'm a clinician. And I see patients every day, and I don't take lightly to saying that I think something has a high potential without really meaning it, because I see these patients again and again, and they'll come right back to me a year later and say, well, you said you were going to do this, or you said this was so fantastic, and it doesn't work. And that's happened enough that my ego has been bashed enough that I don't like false hope. And so My feeling is right now that stem cell technology is way far away for muscle diseases. I've got a lot of experience with Duchenne muscular dystrophies as well, and I just know where they're at, and I have not been convinced in any shape or form that, you know, that yes, they can show that some stem cells turn into muscle cells, but can they do it at a level that is required to treat a human? They're not even close. Whereas gene therapy, which I'm not saying is like right on the doorstep, but it's the technology and the evidence is light years ahead. In my point of view.
Excuse me, Doctor. This is Alicia.
Hi.
How soon would we have, if once we had the vaccination, you know, for the gene?
Yeah.
When would we have to go back for a second time? Or you don't know that?
Well, it depends on your age.
Okay.
So let me put it to you this way. Mm-hmm. If you're a baby and you have zero residual enzyme activity, you got absolutely zero GAA in your body.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
Then we come in with the virus. I can tell you that mimics the situation that we have in our animal model. And we found that a single injection keeps the glycogen down in the muscle for at least 6 months.
Okay.
If not longer. We kind of ran out of mice in the experiment. Because it worked that long. I wasn't even expecting it to work that long. It works longer in the heart. It probably works even longer in the heart than 6 months. The skeletal muscle, though, we start seeing the glycogen starting to creep up at 6 months. So the question would be, okay, let's say 6 months, maybe a year. At that point, then, you'd have to do something.
Okay.
You'd either come back in with another virus that was a little different so the body wouldn't reject it, or you start with the enzyme.
Okay.
Now, Let's take the alternative patient. Let's take a patient who's 20, 25 years old that presents with their first symptoms. That means, by definition, that they've got enough GAA activity in their body. Maybe it's not perfect, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's enough that it kept them going for 20 years before they manifested enough symptoms to really become a problem. Now, if we go into that individual and clean all their glycogen out with our virus, remember, they've still got their residual enzyme in their body. They may be able to go another 20 years before they reaccumulate enough that we didn't have to come back in with something.
Oh, okay.
You see how that works? And that's why I've proposed, and this will be likely what we will do, at least from where I stand right now, that the first patients that would receive the gene therapy would more likely be adults for that reason.
Okay.
Because we don't have the grave worries about what are we going to do in 6 months.
Yeah.
See, the babies have been treated with the enzyme because we can go in with the enzyme week after week after week.
Mm-hmm.
You see, we don't have to worry about that rejection. And so we don't have to worry about what happens, you know, when the enzyme goes away, because we can just give them another dose.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And so that's a little bit more reasonable from a number of practicable aspects.
I have a question about the initial gene treatment.
Yeah.
Where when you go in and you said that you would try to clean up the glycogen, it would be sort of a cleanup dose. I guess
yes.
That would be a high
yes.
gene dose.
Yes.
Obviously, there would be immune suppression at that time. Is that
not,
that what
not necessarily? Not necessarily. Everything I've talked about right now and what we've published has been without immune suppression.
Okay. And I am speaking of a patient with zero enzyme activity.
Right. Well, that would be an infant then.
Right.
So an infant, there's a couple of reasons why they can have zero enzyme activity, and I don't want to go into the details of that.
Okay.
But by definition, a juvenile or adult onset patient would have to have some enzyme activity. Typically, they say greater than 2% or 5% or whatever the heck that means. It doesn't mean anything, really. What you really look at is the patient, and you say, this person is 20 years old because they must have some GAA in their body. And that person would more likely tolerate enzyme, they would more likely tolerate GAA produced from a virus than, let's say, a baby that doesn't produce any.
Right.
And so
the baby would produce antibodies
to the GAA.
Right, right.
Right. That's a hypothesis. Now, that's one that I kind of hold high. Now, there's debate. There's debate on that point from a number of groups, and it's still up in the air whether that truly happens or whether it really matters.
Mm-hmm.
I offer you that is a point that's up for debate.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Now, the virus, let's talk a little bit about the virus may need to require some transient immunosuppression. Let's say we go in with the virus. I suspect we might have to go this route where if we have to give the virus, we may have to transiently immune suppress somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say for like a week before we give the virus and a week after we give the virus. Nothing like a tissue transplant that we do nowadays where you're immune suppressed for life. So this is something much relative on a relative scale, much milder than something like that.
What does that mean, actually, doctor?
As far as immune suppress?
Yeah.
Well, what I'm trying to do is your body, if I were to take this virus and inject it into me or inject it into you, or what I use right now is animal models, your body has evolved over millions of years to fight infections and to fight them and to recognize them rapidly. And your body doesn't realize that this virus is coming in to deliver this gene that will help you. Your body's immune system is saying, this is a virus. There's a ton of virus coming in. We got to get rid of this because we're being infected. And that triggers all kinds of alarm signals. And most of you should be familiar with these alarm signals. You fever, your muscles shake, you feel ill. Those are all your immune system activators sort of getting into gear and getting ready to fight this infection. And if at the doses I'm talking about, you will really ramp up those responses to the point where you can sometimes get into such severe symptoms as shock. And so that's where and that's where I fear that the dose of the virus that we're working with right now is very close to a dose that might induce that in some patients. And what I don't want to do is jeopardize the future of a therapy by not adequately adjusting that dose appropriately.
How might the dosage compare to the patient in
In Philadelphia?
In Philadelphia.
Yeah.
How might the dose compare to that?
Well, that dose that they used in Philadelphia
The same virus, right?
It's the same virus. Okay. We use a little slightly different flavor, but basically same virus. That dose in that individual in Philadelphia has been given at the same dose to other people in Philadelphia at the same time without any problems, as well as about 30 or 40 other patients in other trials that I'm aware of. But you go much higher than that dose and you start running into more and more problems. So the Philadelphia case is sort of, it's still not quite clear what happened. But what I would tell you is it's clear that once you approach those doses, you start hitting those toxicities that would be a problem. I think he had underlying problems. He had underlying liver disease, actually, which likely made him especially sensitive. But I suspect that dose is pretty close to where my upper sort of limit is for how high we would go. And I can tell you in our animal models, where we see really good response is just below that dose. Just below. But it's very close to that dose. And it turns out that you can go lower on the dose and you can affect improvement in glycogen clearance, let's say, just in heart muscle, but not in skeletal muscle.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, if you're a juvenile or adult patient, you're not affected by cardiac disease. I mean, classically, you're not. So our target would be skeletal muscle, and skeletal muscle turns out that you need a higher dose of virus to achieve an effect. And so it's sort of a catch-22.
Why do you think the skeletal muscle is so much
more resistant?
More resistant. Is it just the amount of receptors that is expressed?
That's a good question. Again, up for debate, and I put this into all my papers that I don't know. It could be that there's a receptor problem, and we're investigating that at Duke. It could be that muscle cell glycogen, for some reason, is less accessible to the enzyme than heart glycogen. It could be that heart is more vascular and has a better blood flow, so it gets more enzyme per time, per liter of blood that flows past it. There's a number of reasons, or there's a number of observations which demonstrate that the skeletal muscle is more resistant, but the exact mechanism is unclear. But we're trying to figure that out.
I got a question about the virus. If you try to maximize the virus input with the gene, if you reach a level of toxicity because you're trying to maximize the amount and try to clear that glycogen in that initial dose, once you go over the edge and the body then sort of jumps on the virus and sort of overpowers it.
Yes.
And you'd say you would probably shut down the what you're doing so that the body could recover. If you tried to go back in and do it again, the body would be ready to kill the virus immediately. So I guess that goes back to what you were saying about having a different virus in line.
Yeah. Well, actually, something a little different. When I say shut down, I mean a clinical trial. Like, for example, let's say I'm doing patient number one, number two, number three, and each patient I'm increasing the dose of the virus to try and find where that magic dose is that gets a good response. I'm afraid that, let's say in patient 13, I would start running into problems where the patient's blood pressure might start dropping after I infuse the virus, that they might get a very big fever, they get shock-like symptoms, and at that point, the FDA, as well as myself, would say, this is getting perilously close, that we're going to do more damage to the patient than good.
Yeah, you've encroached upon the maximum at that point.
Right, so that's what we call the MTD, or maximally tolerated dose, okay? Now, it depends. Now, I'll tell you, It becomes an ethical issue, as far as I'm concerned.
It's kind of a person thing. It depends on that particular person.
Right.
Well.
Now, you wouldn't do this to someone to try and cure baldness, right?
Okay.
Right.
I'm out of luck there.
Right. Sorry. But for someone that has a disease like Pompe disease, which every day robs you of another day of, you know, movement and the ability to live your life, I view that as equivalent to cancer.
Right.
You know, it's a lethal disorder.
Right.
And I'm not going to, you know, as far as when I'm ready to go to the FDA or whatever element, I will present it in that guise that we are not dealing here with some, you know, mild disorder. We're talking about something that's robbing people every day. And so the standards should be elevated a little bit. Now, I will not risk people's lives. I mean, I sort of think of it as, you know, if my brother had this condition, would I subject him to this?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not there yet.
Right.
Now, I could have easily done a trial, I think, several years ago with the data we had. In fact, our data is better than what they had in Philadelphia. But I don't feel justified to do it yet because there is that risk, and I'm not willing to subject people to that risk unless I'm absolutely confident that we're going to get at least a reasonable chance that it'll show some effect in persons.
Yeah, it's kind of a patient by patient.
Because I'll tell you, I bet you can answer me if I'm wrong, but I bet you if I started a clinical trial right now knowing that this all we're going to do is a dose-finding study and we don't have any hope of this ever producing enough enzyme to do nothing, I don't think I can do it.
Right, because they would regulate you too much, and
they would regulate. And plus, if something, you know, well, I think more of you, for example. I mean, I've talked to many patients that have the condition. I try and interact, and most people are like, hey, give it to me, you know.
Right,
they're ready and willing.
Sign me up.
Right, you know, and you see, I'm not going to take advantage of that until you know I am convinced that you're volunteering for something that shows at least some semblance of having what we call efficacy, you know, rather than me just saying, hey, I've done some patients, it didn't help them, but I wrote this paper, how wonderful am I, you know, I mean, I don't need that, and you don't need that either. So what we're trying to do is tweak the system, and the reason I have that little room to do that is because we do have the enzyme therapy coming along as well, and so that sort of is a sort of a backup for me as far as the urgency.
That does sound very attractive, what you were saying about the conjunction of the two
right.
bars working with together.
And in fact, Genzyme, which is you all know is moving forward on the enzyme therapy, is very well up to date on everything I'm talking about here, and they certainly perk up interest when I present it in the guise of maybe this will become an adjunct to facilitate getting therapy to a greater number of patients, maybe in a more reasonable, and it may even be easier to produce overall at some level, if you believe that.
Well, it's massive amounts of enzymes that, our son, for instance, he's 19 months old, and he's getting a tremendous amount of enzymes.
Right.
For as little as he is, and when he is, say, 20 years, if this works the way it is, and we definitely pray that it does.
Right.
If he's 20 years old, if he's 150 pounds
right.
with no enzyme, he's getting a tremendous amount of enzyme.
Right. And so that scale is something that I've a lot of patients have had trouble understanding why the trials have been so slow to proceed. I mean, I've had people in my office, demanding enzyme for their baby, thinking that I'm sitting on some stockpile, that I'm not.
He would be going in. It would look like a 1 gallon container hanging above him, at least.
Right.
Oh my God.
And so it's not like aspirin where we can mass produce this stuff. The recombinant enzyme is something that is incredibly complex and regulated, and it has to be because this is if it were easy, people would have did it 30 years ago. Now I will tell you, the virus actually is fairly, I'll say this, the grain of salt, relatively easier to make. And my example is that this same virus has actually been used to vaccinate military recruits over the years. So people used to catch adenovirus infections when they go into boot camp, and it would take out a whole unit, and so everybody would have to redo, basic training. So the military didn't like that. And so they actually vaccinated military recruits with large doses of this virus. They would actually give the military recruits a pill, and they would swallow it. And they were able to produce enough to treat millions of people. So you can scale the virus up if it shows that it can work.
Now, the study that already has, and have they actually gained weight?
Could you repeat that question again? I'm sorry.
The people who have had minimal trials with this enzyme, have they actually gained weight?
Have the people, let me see if I repeat the question, have the people that have received enzyme gained weight?
Mm-hmm.
The babies have. The babies that have responded, typically when they start out, they're what we call failure to thrive. That's typically how many babies with Pompe disease get picked up by their local pediatricians, that they aren't gaining weight. And we found that in the babies that respond, and remember, some of the babies don't respond, and we're still trying to figure out why. In the babies that respond, they quickly gain strength. Their ability to suck on a bottle, let's say, for example, improves, and they gain weight, mostly because they're feeding better.
Yeah, this is Marilyn House. I think that's just because they're feeling better, and they're when you feel better, you're better able to eat and function. I had a question about gene therapy. For years, we understood that with gene therapy, that was kind of the cure, that it would be a one-time thing, and maybe no other treatments would be necessary after that. It seems now that, we have heard in the past that it might be used in conjunction with enzyme replacement therapy. So it's still going to be a ongoing treatment. It's not going to be something that's
permanent.
Why is that?
Why is that? Well, I'll tell you, first of that is I never said it would be lifelong. If you understand how it's done, we're actually not repairing the genetic mutation in every cell in your body. We're simply adding a new copy of the genetic information into the cells that we can reach. And when we do that, we don't do it in a permanent fashion. Okay? For example, that virus that we use does not integrate into your genes and become one with them.
Right.
Okay? And so, now, I will tell you, though, that everything I'm telling you is conservative. the responses that we're seeing in the animals, I think, could go much longer, and I think in a human they can go much longer, and the reason is the following. If we could deliver the gene into every liver cell in your body, let's say, your liver typically doesn't turn over every day. And what I mean by that is the liver cells that you have right now are the same ones you're going to have in 20 years.
Oh.
Okay, unless you drink a lot of alcohol and burn them all out. Okay? And so those liver cells, if I can get the gene into them now, as long as there isn't an immune response to those liver cells, that they're eliminated, they could potentially last lifelong. So even though I'm not, what I'm telling you is it's likely we would have to repeat it. That's because I always hedge my bets when it comes to patients, okay? I'm not going to go out on a limb and say this is going to be a one-time shot. If that happens, that's fine. I'll be very happy. But reality tells me that there's a number of reasons why that might not last that long. So there is still that possibility that it could last years. I think it can. But until we actually do it, we won't know.
Would it be preferable to target muscle rather than liver, or is it just that's where it happens to land? And
so we've investigated this and actually published it. And preferably, yes, it'd be nice to hit the muscle directly. So imagine what we'd have to do with this virus. We'd have to inject it into your muscles, right? And it turns out when you do that, the virus doesn't magically diffuse to all the muscle cells. So I have to give you several thousand injections, let's say, just to hit a little muscle in your foot.
Right.
If I wanted to correct that muscle.
Is there a virus that specifically targets muscle?
Well, actually, adenovirus does to a certain degree,
okay.
But your body is already designed to prevent that from happening. You've got compartments, sort of like a ship, you know, that if one compartment floods, the next one kind of locks down.
Bulkhead.
Yeah, and so your body is not going to allow some virus free reign through all the cells of its body. It's already set up to have sort of firewalls, if you will.
Is it common that a virus, if you inject it systemically, that it targets to the liver?
Yes, and the reason is, again, that's one of the functions of your liver, is actually to filter out viruses. It turns out it's one of your big organs that filters out viruses. So what we're doing is we're taking advantage of that. When we inject the virus into the vein, a great amount of it is taken into the liver. And then we make the liver secrete this enzyme to supply all the muscle cells.
Like a little manufacturing.
Right, like a little genzyme in your body, so to speak. You know.
A little UPS depot.
Right. And now, it turns out your liver, that's what it normally does, is secrete enzymes. It turns out it secretes this enzyme fairly efficiently, and it probably secretes it in a form that's even better than the enzyme that's provided from either CHO cells or transgenic or whatever, because it's a human actually making it. And that's something that we'll wait and see if that's true.
Do you know what percentage of the genzyme enzyme is actually in a form that binds to the receptor?
Well, we don't know what the receptor is, actually.
I thought they knew it was mannose-6-phosphate.
That's well, you would think so, and that's what everybody says, but it's not entirely clear that is what is responsible, maybe partly responsible. And then people have looked at various, what I've heard John Crowley call it, decorations on the enzyme that supposedly facilitate uptake into muscle cells. And those correlations, I think, have fallen by the wayside. I don't think you can correlate that. I think what you can correlate is if you have a given enzyme that you've produced in a certain manner, if you put it on patient's fibroblasts or patient muscle cells, you measure how much goes in. And then it tells you. And usually it's typically 30-50% efficient, something like that.
So do you know what percent is phosphorylated? I know they were trying to make a highly phosphorylated enzyme, and that's kind of disappeared. No one talks about that anymore. Is that still a goal? Is that something that would increase uptake in the muscle, or they just don't know? I mean, that's
theoretically. Okay. And that's all I'm going to say. Theoretically, but remember, I mean, doing something in a little laboratory dish with something that supposedly works better, you got to think about, okay, now in a human body, you've got about a million other variables going on right. that are going to try and defeat that result. Right. You know, there's any number of things that are floating around in your blood.
And they even showed evidence that this highly phosphorylated enzyme required a much smaller dosage at one point.
Yeah, I haven't seen that evidence.
In the animal model.
It's definitely not published.
Okay. I read it somewhere. I don't know. And maybe it wasn't published. But
no, it's not been published as far as I know.
Okay.
And that's the other thing. Most of the things that I've talked about today are all published, and you can go look and read it for yourself. That I'm not sort of going over the top here at some level.
I don't mean to hog the platform. I have so many questions. What about naked DNA, plasmid DNA injected into the muscle? Because the muscle tends to take it up pretty efficiently.
Yeah. I've yet to see convincing evidence that you can get enough muscle corrected at one time that you would clear the glycogen in all the muscle. Typically, people in practice, now, people do inject DNA into muscles of live human patients. In fact, several thousand have been injected. This has been typically done to induce sort of like a vaccine, you know, where you're going to try and immunize somebody to anthrax or Ebola or HIV or something like that. And I'll tell you, when they do that, the responses are very weak, if anything. And that's to generate, you know, a little immune response. To try and generate enough enzyme to correct all the muscles in your body is like light years ahead. It's an order of magnitude higher efficiency you need to get.
One thing it does have going for it, though, there's less chance. I mean, there's virtually no cytotoxicity, right? With
It would be more benign, but so is water. I mean, it doesn't do nothing either. Now, I have seen some intriguing things that we may be pursuing where people have actually taken DNA, but instead of injecting it directly into the muscle, they actually take it and inject it intravenously. Now here's the example. They actually put like a big old blood pressure cuff on an arm or a limb of an animal, and so they inject the DNA into the vein locally and under high pressure, and they typically add noxious kind of things to kind of make the blood vessels a little leaky. And at that point, they can start getting that DNA into more and more muscle groups in animals. So that's something that's being pursued, and I'm intrigued by that. I haven't seen, I've just seen it at meetings, and we may be pursuing it here as well. I just don't know. You could do a lot of things to a mouse and a rat that you can't do in a human, and this may be just an artifact of that, but it's interesting.
You talked about leakiness of the
blood. We have about 5 minutes left. I just wanted to...
Okay.
Oh, can I finish?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. You talked about leakiness of the blood vessels. How permeable are blood vessels to not only the enzyme, but what about the virus also?
Well, it's, you know, if our blood vessels weren't so tight, we'd be like walking bags of jelly.
Right.
You know, so our blood vessels are meant to keep fluid in and regulate what passes through. And that likely, you're absolutely correct, that is definitely influencing where the enzyme gets out, okay? And because the enzyme has to go across the blood vessel barrier to get to the target cell. Same thing with our virus when we inject it.
I think that could be partially accounting for the higher dosages?
It could be. It could be that and plus... Well, you're saying higher dosages relative to what diseases, like Gaucher, right?
Gaucher or Fabry.
Yeah. Well, remember, those cells... Where are those cells in Fabry disease or Gaucher? They're in the bloodstream.
Yeah.
So they got, like, the enzyme, you know, they're bathed in it.
Right.
Your muscle cells are sort of like on the other side of the window looking in saying, hey, please come here.
So it may be a permeability issue why the muscle is not...
Right. Right. And so now the question is, if you can permeabilize muscle to allow some of these gene transfer agents better access, that might be something. The question is, will you do more damage...
Right.
By doing that as well, and I think those are questions that are still out there, but I think there's another angle there, another hope. So I'm pretty optimistic that We'll get it this some way.
Wouldn't it be that, say, if you injected a virus into the muscle, like it's the same thing you've been saying, the muscle doesn't really transpose material from muscle to muscle. It's kind of a dead end.
Exactly.
It seems like the great delivery system of the body is the venous system, or is the veins and arteries, and
right.
It's your circulatory system.
Exactly.
So that's why you're saying that that would be the target area, and like you just said, the barrier, breaking down that barrier seems
right.
to be the trick.
Right. Unfortunately, you don't want to be, you know, those barriers are there for a reason, and you don't want to interrupt them because you may, again, cause more harm than good. But, you know, it's all relative.
Yeah. It's like everything is its own closed system, whether
exactly.
it's the digestive tract, you know, the
yeah.
respiratory system or muscle system.
Doctor, what do you think in terms of timing for moving forward? Do you have any kind of internal clock to see?
I'll tell you, I'd like it to be yesterday. Personally, I think we're doing some experiments now in animals where we're trying to do these approaches of combining the enzyme with the gene therapy to see if it truly will reduce the need for both, you know, the dose. If we show that in the coming months, then it becomes a decision of do we go ahead with a trial? We would first have to use the virus by itself and then later on do another trial where we combine the two. That's a tall order. That's a lot of money. Genzyme has been committed to that. When the timing is right and when the data supports, you know, going forward with that. If that were to happen, it would take a year to produce the virus to a grade that you could actually give it into humans. And then you would, you know, all the problems that go along with starting a clinical trial. My famous answer is 2 years.
That's what you said 2 years ago.
I know.
Well,
I know.
It's been an hour, and it's been such a wonderful talk. It just flew by for me.
Oh, wow.
Thank you so
Hopefully
much.
I didn't bore you.
Oh, not at all.
Not at all. I had 2 pages of notes.
Okay.
Well, thank you so
I'm
gonna much.
I'm going to quiz you later.
Oh, I don't know.
Thank you, doctor.
All righty. Well, please don't hesitate to call again, or you know, I'll try and interact as best I can, all right?
That's great.
And keep your fingers crossed.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
All right. Bye, Marilyn. Bye, Randall.
Bye.
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 Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.